This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, from occupation to occupy, the Israelification of American domestic security. That's the title of investigative reporter Max Blumenthal's latest article, where he looks into the relationship between Israeli security forces and most of the police departments in the United States.
Many women had given up farming entirely. Female farmers filed a lawsuit against the USDA for gender discrimination in its farm loan programs. Of the 3.3 U.S. farm operators counted in 2007 census data, more than 1 million were women. That number represents a 19% increase in just 5 years. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We have an important update on the recently released International Atomic Energy Association's report on Iran's nuclear program. Politicians and pundits in the press have created a stampede towards war against Iran, alleging that Iran's nuclear program has developed weapons that are going to be imminently used. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The fact of the matter is that Iran halted development of its nuclear program in the year 2003. This has been confirmed by the United States National Intelligence Report. Despite that, the hawks, the pro-Israeli lobby, are trying to rally the population behind what we saw 8 years ago in the attack on Iraq. There was no truth, we found out, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and there's no truth that Iran is about to develop a nuclear capacity to be used against its neighbors in the Near East or even the United States. No truth whatsoever. Nonetheless, you've got to be very cautious about the media because they're trying to stampede public opinion into thinking that Iran is doing something that it's not doing. The IAEA's report has been analyzed in a recent article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is a decades-old magazine devoted to opposing nuclear proliferation. It has that famous clock up in the corner of the front cover, and every time the danger gets worse, the minute hand gets closer to midnight. And the bulletin is accorded great respect around the world. Two of its authors, Greg Thielman and Benjamin Locre, conclude that when earlier this month the International Atomic Energy Agency released a report on Iran's nuclear program, several media agencies and politicians walked away with two messages: that the Vienna-based agency now refutes past estimates of the U.S. intelligence community, and that Iran is now making a break for the bomb. Both representations are false. Liberty Square, formerly Zuccotti Park, is a place that I've got to walk by on my way to my law office and also on my way home, so I see it twice a day. It's really extraordinary what they've done to that park. The park is ringed by not one but two rows of steel fences. The fences are held together by those plastic handcuffs. Outside the fence, you have New York City Police Department. You've got that platform that goes up like a scissors about 40 feet in the air with darkened windows, a searchlight trained on the park, and a cop up there looking at what's going on. You've got three squad cars parked along the northern rim of the park. You've got a paddy wagon and a command control wagon. Inside the park, you have eight private rent-a-cops in chartreuse vests that the Brookfield Property has hired. Brookfield Property, which incidentally is a division of U.S. Steel, owns the park. And they've hired these rent-a-cops. The rent-a-cops are there alone. There's no one in the park this morning. Trees in the park are festooned with Christmas lights. So you picture, you got a double-ringed in steel park with nothing but cops on the outside and on the inside, and lit up trees with nobody in there using it. A triumph of hygiene and sanitation over the public's right to assembly. That's what Mayor Mike has done to Zuccotti Park. Going north 3 miles, we have a report from Washington Square Park. Washington Square Park is now giving $250 tickets to musicians. They're saying that musicians are vendors and that the young people that come to play and to busk, busking is a sacred tradition amongst musicians because in this country you can't make a living as an artist. And a lot of people go out and play on street corners or in parks. They put out a hat and they get donations. That's been a tradition in Washington Square Park going back 60, 70 years. Washington Square Park was the fountain of the folk revival movement in the late 50s and 60s. When I was at law school at NYU, I lived in a dormitory right across from the park, and I'd study all the time, but on Sunday afternoon I would take off and I would go into the park, and you had some of the finest folk musicians anywhere that would be playing in the park. In fact, the cops tried to clear them out in the early 60s, and Dave Van Ronk writes about this in his posthumous memoir, The Mayor of McDougal Street. And Van Ronk writes about how everybody rallied and they took back the park and claimed that as ground for musicians to come and play. That was in the early 60s, so 50 years musicians have been going to Washington Square Park and playing. Well, not anymore. 2 days ago, there was a report on WBAI News that 24 musicians so far have been given $250 tickets. The last one was a young girl with a guitar, $250. So you can't go there and busk anymore. The police are enforcing Mayor Bloomberg's non-commercialization rule. He says that they're trying to commercialize the parks. Now, this is from a mayor who rents out Bryant Park for Fashion Week, rents out Union Square Park for all these Christmas booths that sell Christmas presents for 7 weeks a year. When it comes to a person trying to supplement his or her income by playing the banjo or the guitar or anything else in Washington Square Park, and where people want to come and listen to them, I mean, tourists come and listen to them. I take friends who come from out of town to listen to them. It used to be fantastic to go to Washington Square Park. Well, it ain't no more, thanks to Mayor Mike. We have two more related updates, one on New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg and the other on a federal program called the 1033 program. The 1033 program started in the late 90s as an effort to allow municipalities to purchase military weapons. Last year alone, cities across the country purchased $500 million, that's $500 million, worth of military equipment, almost for free from the Army. The military equipment are things like, for example, in Cobb County, Georgia, which is one of the wealthiest and most educated counties in the United States, now owns an amphibious tank. And the sheriff of Richland County in South Carolina proudly acquired a machine gun equipped armored personnel carrier called the Peacemaker. This militarization of our nation's police force is an ominous development. Tim Lynch, who directs the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice, wrote recently on the internet that it's a kind of had a corrupting influence on the culture of policing in America. The dynamic is that you have some officer go to the chief and say, people in the next county have military hardware. If we don't take some of it, another city will. Then they acquire the equipment, they create a paramilitary unit, and everything seems fine. But then 1 or 2 years pass, and they say, look, we've got this equipment, this training, and we haven't been using it. That's where it starts to creep into routine policing. How does this spill over to, say, New York City? Well, last week in November, Mayor Bloomberg, speaking in Boston, bragged that New York City has what he termed the 7th largest army in the world. That's his police force. He said, quote, it's my private army. That army has, he boasted, the capacity to bring down an aeroplane. And as we know, these highly militarized police forces across the country coordinated their efforts using military tactics to destroy and disperse some 16 Occupy Wall Street encampments around the country. There has been, as we've seen, a massive coordinated effort among federal, state and local police to destroy and suppress the Occupied Wall Street movement. In Max Blumenthal's recent article, From Occupation to Occupy, the Israelification of American domestic security, he digs deep and reveals critical connections at every level of law enforcement with Israel's national security apparatus. Recently, the New York Police Department disclosed its use of counter-terror measures against Occupy protesters at Zuccotti Park. There are more connections yet to be made, says Blumenthal. He joins us today to talk more about his research. Max, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, great to be on with you.
You've written what we all think is an important article called The Israelification of American Domestic Security. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is actually an easier article to write than many people might think because it's all out there. All this information is out there about Israeli training of not just, you know, the American military or American intelligence officers or Israeli intelligence sharing, but training of local police forces from across the country, including from small localities like Sterling, Michigan. And the Israeli training of American police forces is absolutely comprehensive. They've trained over Israeli intelligence, police and military officers have trained over 9,000 American police officers, and that's what we know on the record.
Is that at every level, federal, state, local?
At every level, including the CIA, from the CIA to the FBI to local police forces. For example, Kathy Lanier, who is the police chief of Washington, D.C., one of the most kind of PR-friendly police chiefs, gets tons of good media, said no experience in her life had more of an impact on her doing her job than going to Israel. No experience. The former head of U.S. Capitol Police, who's now the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, Terrence Gaynor, said Israel is the Harvard of anti-terrorism, and so on. Lanier actually said she designed her entire Homeland Security program for the D.C. police based on her experience being trained in Israel.
That's a great comfort, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, it's very comforting. It's what's shocking is that these police chiefs really see Israel in a positive light and have no understanding of how it gathered all these techniques or why it supposedly is the Harvard of anti-terrorism.
Well, there's an organization called YAMAM in Israel, and they've come here and worked with American police officers. Talk about that and give us an idea of what precisely YAMAM does.
YAMAM is a unit in the Magav, which is the border police in Israel, which is one of the most thuggish elements of the Israeli military. It's a quasi-police force that also is active in the West Bank. They've shot at me. They've beaten my friends. They've shot at my friends. I've seen them in action. I've actually interviewed several of them. This is not a group really known for honoring human rights. If anything, it's known for being one of the strong arms of the occupation, including in East Jerusalem. And the YAMAM, which is the elite force of the Magav, the border police, trained alongside members of the Alameda County Sheriff's Department in Berkeley, California, September, at an exhibition called Urban Shield 2011, which is like a SWAT team exposition where they practice coordination and compete with one another for who can carry out raids, you know, with the most timeliness, etc. This is remarkable because they were preparing. The Occupy movement had just started in Oakland, and all of the you know, police departments and sheriffs in California were preparing to coordinate to take down this movement alongside this Israeli strike force and a strike force from Bahrain.
Yeah, that was, really interesting to learn that. Who is this strike force from Bahrain that worked with the Israelis to train the police department in Alameda? It's Oakland and Berkeley is Alameda County. It's in the northern part of the Bay Area near San Francisco. But who's the Bahrain organization?
Well, we need to know that. We don't, so much of this is out there, but the information is incomplete, and we've never had a public discussion on it. For example, we've never had congressional hearings on why elements from an autocratic dictatorship like Bahrain, which was shooting demonstrators at the time by the dozens, which was shooting people as they entered hospitals to get treatment, was allowed to train with our police forces. There needs to be a congressional investigation into this because we don't know who they are. All I know is that they were there because Urban Shield's website said so. And what's most remarkable about this exercise and this training is that I found, I looked in a police trade magazine which was covering the exposition, Urban Shield at the time. And it said, law enforcement, this is a quote from Police Magazine, law enforcement agencies responding to Occupy protesters in Northern California credit Urban Shield for their effective teamwork. Now, of course, you remember what happened when the Alameda County Sheriffs and the Oakland Police Department confronted Occupy Oakland. They shot them with tear gas rounds, with flashbang grenades, with rubber bullets. And as I reported for Al Akhbar English, these are the same exact tear gas rounds that are used by Israeli forces in the West Bank. They're buying them from the same company.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania.
From Pennsylvania and from another company called Defense Tech in Wyoming. There's, you know, not just the sharing of tactics, there's a sharing of weaponry that's being used against American civilians, against kids who think their birthright was sold. That was first tested on Palestinians. So the training is coming from a country that is supposed to be a light unto the nations, but really what it has to share is a 63-year experience of controlling and dispossessing an indigenous population, and they're sharing it with our police forces, who believe that they're you know, studying with some kind of Harvard professors of anti-terrorism.
The Israelis came over to California to train police in California, but what about American police going over to Israel?
You know, the bridge for American police officers to go to Israel is the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs.
And who makes them up?
This is a Washington, D.C. Think tank with an arm in Jerusalem, I think, which is really well known for stridently kind of typical neoconservative policy positions. A lot of the people who were involved in making the case for the Iraq War were at JINSA, like Douglas Feith and Richard Pearl, who wrote the Clean Break document for Benjamin Netanyahu, which really served as a blueprint for, you know, taking over the Middle East and was kind of considered a roadmap for the Iraq War. JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, has a law enforcement education program called LEAP, which is based on its education program for U.S. military officers. And they claim to have trained, through Israeli-led training sessions, over 9,000 American law enforcement officials.
I mean, these law enforcement officials go over to Israel, are taken on tour of Israel,
yeah,
and shown what Israel does with respect to the Palestinians, and they're supposed to learn lessons from this?
Yeah, like a typical trip was in 2004, and JINSA brought 14 senior law enforcement officials, including Kathy Lanier, the D.C. police chief, who I mentioned earlier. One of the things they learned was how to secure large venues such as shopping malls, sporting events, and concerts, which would indicate that they're learning crowd control training, like how to crack down on something like Occupy. One of their tour guides was Brigadier General Simon Perry, who is a police attaché in Israel, but he's also a former Mossad official and tank commander. They toured the separation wall, which is really there for demographic reasons to, you know, enhance the control and domination of occupied Palestinians, but they learn about it as sort of a security measure. They also learn how to take down and look out for suicide bombers, and I don't understand how this would apply to their work in the United States. All it does is increase the already present hostility that cops have for the civilian population. They learned, this is according to the New York Times, in a report that was completely buried, although the police are typically told to aim for the chest when shooting because it is the largest target, the Israelis are teaching American officers to aim for a suspect's head so as not to detonate any explosives that might be strapped to his torso.
Yeah, well,
and that's absurd.
It truly is. But other than JINSA, there's an American organization called the Police Executive Research Forum,
yes,
which we've covered previously on Law and Disorder. And they've participated in coordinating these efforts also. Please talk to us about that, Max Blumenthal.
Well, the Police Executive Research Forum is the group that arranged the conference call between 16 local police chiefs to coordinate the raids on the Occupy movement. That it was one of the first examples of that kind of coordination between municipalities on crushing a national protest movement. And this organization, PERF, which is led by a former senior law enforcement official named Chuck Wexler, is taking officers over to Israel, I think, annually on trips to do pretty much what JINSA's doing. And Wexler initially went on a JINSA trip and was so overcome with enthusiasm for the way that Israelis were doing business, that he decided to start his own program. And I tried to reach Wexler. I called him. He didn't return my calls, but I wanted to learn more about his program because there isn't a lot on the record about it. But this is another area that should be, that I think demands a national conversation.
Well, Max, you wrote that 16 cities across America had their police forces coordinated in
right.
crushing the Occupy movement, and that there may have been some other 40 cities also involved with PERF.
40 cities have sought advice from PERF on how to suppress the Occupy movement and to prepare for other mass protest activities. So, I mean, my question is, you know, how much is Israeli training going into PERF's advice versus, you know, traditional tactical SWAT team, crowd suppression, Daryl Gates style guidelines, which are not exactly very friendly to civilians to begin with.
Talk to us about Daryl Gates style, because our listeners may not be familiar with the gentleman.
Well, when you ask about Daryl Gates, you're asking about the whole history of the militarization of the police force. Daryl Gates was the police chief of the Los Angeles Police Department during the 80s, very close friend of Ronald Reagan, who was the former governor of California, a very right-wing governor. And before Gates, you know, there was Chief Parker at the LAPD. He ran a notoriously corrupt police force. But, you know, these are the kind of cops that, you know, they appear in vintage noir movies, and they're the corrupt guy you can buy off. But you know him. He's walking the beat. He's drinking coffee with you at the diner. And because of that corruption, Gates was brought in to clean up the police force. But what he did was he militarized the police force. He gave, you know, his cops machine guns and bulletproof vests. And he trained them to treat the civilian population as though they were, you know, Gates is a Vietnam vet. I think he's a former Green Beret. He gave them helicopters to treat them as if they're in a battlefield. And this is at the beginning of the dawn of the war on drugs. So that Gates was sort of this figure who ramped up hostility, especially to L.A.'s inner-city population, besieged the inner city, would actually cordon off entire areas. He cordoned off a Pico Union, a Latino neighborhood in Los Angeles, and put it under curfew at one point, installed checkpoints through an operation he called Operation Hammer, and this led directly to the L.A. riots. So the first phase of militarization of, you know, American police was the war on drugs. But through the war on terror and 9/11, the boogeyman of the African-American super predator has morphed into the bearded Islamic evildoer, and that has led American police towards Israel, towards this country carrying out the longest military occupation in modern history.
Yeah, 63 years. And that leads me to my next question, Max Blumenthal. The Anti-Defamation League has also worked with American law enforcement, and I wanted you to talk to our audience about that. Who is the Anti-Defamation League, and what have they done here?
Well, you're supposed to think of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, as a Jewish civil rights group that fights the defamation of the Jewish people and humanity. But this is not, you know, what, you know, the extent of the ADL's work. The ADL has actually trained over 700 law enforcement personnel through its extremist and terrorist threats course. This involved, and this is from all agencies across the country. And this course is heavily dependent on Israeli training and trainers. And, you know, for example, 115 law enforcement officials have undergone ADL sessions in Israel. I mean, the rest of these cops may have done it in the United States with Israeli trainers. And these are major figures, like the former deputy, like the current deputy commissioner of the Philadelphia Police Department, who said that the training from the ADL is the most useful training course he's ever attended.
Well, what kind of stuff do they train him in?
This is interesting. I mean, I don't know exactly what the material is beyond what the Israelis typically train them on, which is what I talked about before, like handling a suicide bomb situation and pretty hyping up the Israeli security model of profiling, which is really racial profiling and behavior detection, that kind of thing. But one of the other things the ADL does, which I find remarkable, and they've trained over 45,000 American law enforcement officials through this program, the Law Enforcement and Society program, is Holocaust education. Now, it's important that everyone learn the lessons of the Holocaust, although there are different lessons to be taught. Abe Foxman, the head of the ADL, has justified or supported a few family members of 9/11 victims who wanted to prevent an Islamic community center from being built in downtown New York on the basis that they're entitled to their bigotry, just like Holocaust survivors. And he himself is a Holocaust survivor who basically admitted being bigoted. So he's talking about sort of the exclusivist view of the Holocaust. All new FBI agents are required to be taken to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. by the ADL. And this is according to official FBI recruitment material that I found. All new special agents must visit the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum to see firsthand what can happen when law enforcement fails to protect individuals. I mean, again, it's completely absurd. I don't think Hitler came to power because of a failure of law enforcement.
Now, Hitler came to power precisely because he was aided by law enforcement. Max, there's a particular odious Israeli figure called Avi Dichter.
Yeah.
And he's had some influence here in fighting what they call crime terror. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, Avi Dichter is the former head of Israel's Shin Bet Internal Security Service. And Shin Bet is heavily involved in training American police forces and American airport personnel now. Dichter is an accused war criminal. I know CCR has a really great file online about him because during the Second Intifada, Dichter authorized several bombings on populated Palestinian civilian areas, including one on the Al-Daraj neighborhood of Gaza, on an apartment block where there was a suspected Palestinian militant, Salah Shahada, sleeping. And Dichter knew that this apartment block was filled with sleeping children and women as well, and he authorized the bombing strike knowing that it would cause dozens of civilian casualties, wound up killing 8 children and severely injuring 150 people. Dichter said, after each success, the only thought is, okay, who's next? Despite this, Dichter was brought to the United States when he was the Minister of Public Security in Israel and spoke before the annual convention of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, sitting behind the current FBI Director Robert Mueller and then Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. And he told the cops there that there was an intimate connection between fighting criminals and fighting terrorists. And what the cops were doing was, what they were actually doing is fighting crimi-terrorists. So, you know, he's encouraging them to blur the line between common criminals and terrorists and treat them all sort of in the same Guantanamo-esque way. And after the speech, Mueller and Dichter hugged each other, you know, before the cameras, and Mueller got up and called Dichter his mentor in anti-terror tactics, which I find incredibly chilling.
Really? I wanted you to go into the demographic unit of the New York City Police Department.
Right. You know, my piece goes through so many areas of Israeli and American coordination and Israeli training, from airports to the Mall of the Americas, where an Israeli security team stops and interrogates 1,200 American shoppers a year. But one of the most disturbing things for us New Yorkers is the fact that the NYPD, under the leadership of Ray Kelly, the commissioner, who's been to Israel repeatedly, speak at Israeli neoconservative conferences, has set up a demographic unit to spy on Muslim communities around the city. And this language of demographics is distinctively Israeli. And what they do is they dispatch undercover agents known as rakers and mosque crawlers into Palestinian and Pakistani bookstores and restaurants to look for customers looking at radical literature. But they've wound up spying on virtually every area of Muslim life in New York City. And the Israeli imprimatur on this program is completely clear. The Associated Press, which has done the most comprehensive reporting on it, reported that the demographics unit has attempted to map New York City's human terrain through a program modeled in part on how Israeli authorities operate in the West Bank. So if this is true, New York is under occupation to some degree. And that's, this is what we call counter-terror creep. That counter-terror tactics that were supposed to be used to prevent the next 9/11 are being used against law-abiding American civilians who are playing by the rules, and it's the cops under Israeli training who are violating the rule of law and the Constitution.
Max, one last question. Let's come back here to New York City, to Zuccotti Park, and the tactics that the New York City Police Department used in the middle of the night to disperse and destroy the encampment of those who are occupying Wall Street.
Yeah, this was reported in the New York Times, and it was buried, not acknowledged. It was never part of a public discussion, but that the NYPD acknowledged that it used counter-terror tactics for that raid. And where did it get its counter-terror tactics from? It appears that they've gotten them primarily through Ray Kelly's coordination with Israel. So while I can't say for certain that the NYPD used Israeli tactics on the Occupy protesters at Zuccotti, I know for a fact that they did use counter-terror tactics. So this is why there needs to be more of a public discussion about this. And I can just tell you, because I was there, what I witnessed reminded me very much of witnessing an Israeli demolition of a village. And I have watched Israeli police come into Bedouin villages and destroy the entire village. And the tactics that I saw there and the tactics that I saw at Zuccotti were identical.
Max Blumenthal, thank you very much for the article you wrote on how the Israelis have influenced American domestic security. And thank you, Max, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. They've always had a presence in the fields, but in recent years, women have come to run a quickly increasing share of America's farms. Of the 3.3 U.S. farm operators counted in 2007 census data, more than 1 million, or nearly one-third, were women. That number represents a 19% increase in just 5 years, greatly outpacing overall growth in the profession. And the proportion of women who are the principal operators of the farms they work on has also increased over the past decade. Females now manage 14% of the nation's 2.2 million farms. Yet throughout this time, women farmers have faced routine and systematic discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In 2001, female farmers filed a lawsuit against the USDA for gender discrimination in its farm loan programs. In the years leading up to the lawsuit, having been repeatedly denied loans by the USDA Farm Service Agency and its predecessor, the Farmers Home Administration, many women plaintiffs had given up farming entirely. The lawsuit claims that many who applied or tried to apply for farm loans were turned down because of their gender. Even the government's own reports confirm claims of widespread gender discrimination. In 2003, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights issued a report highlighting the inadequate civil rights record of the agency. Here to discuss the plight of women farmers and the lawsuit is Christine Dunn from the law firm Arendt Fox in Washington, D.C. Christine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, a lot of people are unaware of how the whole loan industry works vis-a-vis farming. Can you briefly describe how someone, a woman farmer in particular, would come to apply to the government for a loan?
Well, the USDA provides a wide range of loans and credit programs for American farmers. In particular, there are farm operating loans, farm ownership loans, and emergency farm loans in the event that there's a national disaster, for example, that's declared in a particular area from flooding or forest fires or whatnot. And those loans that are provided are effectively a loan of last resort, where farmers have been unable to obtain loans from traditional commercial lenders. And so the USDA offers these loans to farmers whose farming plan is still viable and they're eligible for these loans, but that they just haven't been able to get the funds that they really need to continue the operation, expand the operation, purchase or renovate their land, or purchase cattle or feed or whatever else it might be that they need for the farm.
Tell us briefly about the 2001 lawsuit and how that came to be brought.
So I assume you're referring to the Rosemary Love versus Secretary of Agriculture lawsuit.
Yes.
The Women Farmers lawsuit, which is now Love v. Vilsack, of course, Tom Vilsack being the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, was filed, nearly a decade ago against the USDA by women farmers who were discriminated against based on their gender, based on being women, in being denied farm loans and loan servicing by the USDA local offices all around the country in county offices. And it was so widespread that it got national attention. And there was a women farmer suit, and there have been other minority farmer lawsuits that have been filed as well.
Is this a class action lawsuit?
It was filed initially as a class action on behalf of women farmers all across the country. The courts have not granted it class certification, and that might not be of much surprise to your listeners when I'm sure they've heard about the landmark Walmart litigation with the Supreme Court making a decision on class certification, evidencing that it is increasingly harder, nearly impossible, to have a nationwide class certified anymore.
But in this case, as I understand it, the government has actually admitted gender discrimination over decades.
That is correct. In specific instances, they have admitted that there's been discrimination, but that is not complete throughout. They haven't admitted in every single instance that indeed there is discrimination. What they've admitted is that there has been a problem, that it's been at the local level and there have been problems at the national level as well. That has been problems in their farm loan decisions as well as with their employees. And that's been a general admission, and then there have also been other studies that have been done, reviews by GAO, for example.
The Government Accounting Office.
That's right, and other governmental bodies that have reviewed the situation at USDA and have seen that there have been these long-term discrimination issues. I should say an overlay of that was that in the 1980s, the USDA had, as it has for a long time, an Office of Civil Rights. That office was effectively dismantled so that women farmers or any farmer that had a complaint of discrimination and how they were being treated with regard to their farm loans could call up to the Office of Civil Rights in Washington, D.C. and complain, or they could file a written complaint. And that was actually a requirement for them to do so, for them to be able to preserve their discrimination complaint rights. The problem was that in the 80s, that office was effectively dismantled, and so effectively, no one was answering the phones or opening the mail, and so there were many women who complained, but there was really no one listening, and so their complaints went completely unheeded for quite a long time. When Congress found out about this years later, back in the 90s, it was so outraged that they retroactively extended or opened up the ability for women farmers to bring their discrimination complaints against the USDA, and they had to do so by a date certain in the future, and hence the filing of the women farmers lawsuit.
The USDA is offering financial compensation now
to women who claim that they were subject to discrimination in the past. And I understand that the government says it's offering more money now than in past settlements with African American or Native American farmers who went through the same kind of discrimination. But female farmers or ranchers are being offered up to $50,000, while earlier settlements, I understand, allowed farmers to apply for damages as well, and sometimes many millions of dollars were paid out. Do you know why this is?
No, and actually I should start from the first premise, which is that the USDA is offering money. They've proposed a claims program, a voluntary claims program, that women and actually Hispanic farmers as well who believe they were discriminated against can seek money, and it's up to $50,000. That plan, that program has not been launched. It's anticipated that that will be launched in December 2011 or January 2012. But in effect, there is no money yet. There has been no offer yet to any woman or Hispanic farmer to provide under that program yet.
Do you have any examples or specific stories you can share about how this has impacted one or two female farmers directly?
In addition, you had asked about, you know, why is there such disparity in terms of the monetary awards that are being offered. First, in terms of the individual woman farmer, the women farmer is going to be offered up to $50,000 if she has a successful claim under the USDA's proposed program. In past programs, these are for the African American farmers and for the now ongoing Native American Farmers Claims Program, those amounts have been different. There has been a category where they could get up to $50,000, but then there is also the opportunity to get up to $250,000. And actually, even earlier, the African American farmers were able to seek all of the damages, consequential damages that they had as a result of USDA's discrimination. That is very troubling for the women farmers that they're not being offered the same relief. That's on the individual basis. Then if you talk about on the aggregate, the total amount of the pot of money that's being provided to women, while it's a substantial pot of money, nonetheless, if you look at the number of women farmers and ranchers vis-a-vis the number of African-American farmers or Native American farmers, women farmers vastly outnumber them. So, for example, it's 10 to 1 in terms of the numbers. In the most recent agriculture census, women numbered over 300,000, and African-American principal farm operators only numbered approximately 30,000, just to give you some context of those numbers.
Can you explain why the number of women farm operators has grown so significantly?
Well, I think that women farmers are finding that there's increasing opportunities for them. They don't have, in the past, you know, it was seen to be a man's job. It was stereotypically a man's job to be out working and getting their hands dirty in the field while the woman, the wife, or the mother was back in the farmhouse tending for the household and the children. And those stereotypes have really broken down, and it's shown that women really can do that job, and to be honest, historically have been doing that job, but maybe just haven't been recognized for the farmers that they are. And so we've seen women going out and starting their own farm venture, whether they have the assistance of a spouse or family members or just on their own, or in a business operation, but they have the courage to do that on their own. In addition, women have been at the forefront of advances in organic farming and other types of niche farming that have really grown in popularity.
Can you share an example of how a woman who has been denied a loan has either had to give up the business or suffered hardship?
Well, there's innumerable examples of that. Our lead plaintiff, Rosemary Love, suffered terribly. She had her animals literally dying on her farm because the USDA wouldn't release the funds that she had been awarded through a farm loan. She wasn't provided the loan servicing and the release of those funds for her to buy feed for her animals and to care for them properly. And that is really troubling, where you have a farmer who literally is watching their animals die in front of them. So that's just one horrible example. There's other examples where USDA officials at the local level have propositioned women, have told them to their faces, you know, farming isn't for women, and you shouldn't be farming. Your role is not on the farm, but in the house or caring for your children. And that has been very troubling to them in terms of their self-esteem, but also in terms of their ability to farm, which is, of course, what is at stake here. There have been innumerable women who have lost their farms. I think of, for example, Joyce Acum in New York. The farmland had been in the family since the time of the Civil War, and unfortunately, that farmland was lost when she was not granted the farm loans and loan servicing that she had applied for and that she was entitled to.
If the lawsuit is successful, what do you hope to gain?
Relief for the women farmers, both for those women who have suffered in the past and to make sure that this doesn't happen again to another woman.
If people are interested in this issue, either the lawsuit or in general about women farmers, is there a website they can go to?
There is, womenfarmers.com. So women, plural, farmers, plural, .com is a website that has information for women farmers themselves, but for anyone else as well. It has a lot of information about the lawsuit as well as the government's proposed claims program that they anticipate launching in the next couple of months.
Where are we procedurally with the lawsuit?
The case is on hold. It's been stayed actually for quite a number of years while the government and the women farmers try to meet out a resolution. So we'll be back in court in January.
How have our elected officials weighed in on this issue?
Well, Congress in the 2008 Farm Bill passed sense of Congress language where they implored the administration to resolve these discrimination lawsuits against the USDA because it saw them for what they are, which is a sore on the reputation of the administration. And even USDA Secretary Vilsack last March in testifying before the U.S. Senate Committee on Appropriations Agriculture Subcommittee said, and I quote, "We are very committed to trying to get these cases resolved and closing this rather sordid chapter in USDA history." And we couldn't agree with him more that this is a sordid chapter in the history of the USDA, and we want to move past it and get these resolved. And we just hope that that is soon, very soon, because, of course, many of these women's claims date back to 1981, if you can imagine.
30 years ago. And how have these women survived?
Well, that's quite problematic for many of them. Many of these women, if you can imagine, if this goes back 30 years, they're getting older. For some, it's not an overstatement to say that one of their last dying wishes is that they really want to have this case that they have with the USDA resolved so that they own their farms free and clear. So that, for example, if it's family land, that it stays in the family. Which brings me to a couple of issues that are troubling about the USDA's proposed claims program. One is that the debt relief that's being provided is sorely lacking and substantially less than was provided for other minority groups in the settling of their farm loan discrimination cases. So, for example, the African American and Native American farmers. So, in other words, a woman farmer could be successful in establishing that she indeed was discriminated against. She was wrongly denied a farm loan 30 years ago, and yet all that mounting debt that resulted from that wrong decision, that discrimination, may not all be forgiven. And that is a travesty. It's a tragedy added on to the initial horror of the discrimination. So that's one thing that's a problem. Another thing that is actually very problematic is that the evidentiary requirements of what a woman farmer would have to prove in order to be successful in her claim of discrimination under this proposed claims program is quite onerous. In some instances, even requiring original documents from 30 years ago or firsthand witnesses from 30 years ago. And that, as you can imagine, may very well not exist, depending on if they, you know, their homes have been destroyed or they've lost their homes or those firsthand witnesses truthfully aren't locatable or even are no longer living.
Christine, one wonders why there isn't a push for amnesty to forgive all of these prior loans.
One wonders.
Christine, in many social movements throughout U.S. history, we've seen a strong people's movement support work in the courtrooms. What kind of people's movement is there in support of these farm workers?
I think there's women farmers all across the country who are really believing that there's going to be justice served. And I think there's a long history in the United States of when there's a wrong, no matter how long it takes to be corrected, that it is indeed corrected. And I think they have hope that that will happen. Now, I should add that the statistics actually have shown, we understand that in every one of the 50 states, that women farmers got less than their fair share of farm loans and farm loan servicing, which is really troubling. And it shows that it's not just in little pockets, but it really is nationwide.
That's a sobering statistic. Christine Dunn, thank you so much for your work on this effort and for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. Law and Disorder has a wide geographical coverage in the United States. We have many, many affiliates. Today we want to thank those affiliates. If you broadcast Law and Disorder and don't hear your name as an affiliate, please let us know. If you don't broadcast it, or you have a station that doesn't broadcast it, get them to and help us spread the word of Law and Disorder.
WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee.
KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP, Clay, West Virginia. KRFC, Fort Collins, Colorado.
WRCT, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, KWMD, Anchorage, Alaska, WXOJ, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF, Enid, Oklahoma, 1640 AM, Front Royal, Virginia, WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina.
ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago, Oakland, Atlanta, Boston, Melbourne. Moton Community House Radio, online. WLRI, Gap, Pennsylvania.
WPRR, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS, Columbus Community Radio, Central Ohio. KKFI, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, California. WSLR, Sarasota, Florida. KDX, Internet Radio.
Lorain Community College Radio, Cleveland, Ohio. WHUS, Storrs, Connecticut. WJFF, Radio Catskill.
WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin. WERU, Bangor, Maine. KMUD, Oregon. Garberville, Eureka, Laytonville, Shelter Cove.
Voice of Sacramento, Sacramento Community Radio, Sacramento, California. WWPM, MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois.
Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR, Provincetown. And I'd like to send a special shout out to Provincetown since I grew up there every summer. WMHC, Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Mass. I'd also like to shout out to Mount Holyoke because I did 3 semesters there.
That's a record for Heidi.
Shut up.
KSER, Everett, Washington. WHUS, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington.
WCRS, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, Illinois Central College in Peoria, Illinois.
WGCX, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, Southbridge, Massachusetts. Thank you all.
Misunderstanding.